February 17, 2008, Sunday Feast Lecture, Welcome to Singing, Bhagavad Gita 9:13, 9:14. Hare Krishna.
Hare Krishna.
So we're going to read a little bit from the Bhagavad Gita. First we can chant. Do all of you know me? Or some of you don't know me? My name is Urmila. And I'm here, I'm sure you can tell already, I'm American. I'm here to do curriculum work with the school.
Thank you.
So without the spiritual dimension in life, there's not really much to life, is there? And if we don't have any kind of spiritual dimension in our life, we're not really that much different than the ducks and the pookie crows. Right? If all of our life is made up of is just having some shelter, having some food, having a family, making our name in society, getting some money. It's not a very satisfying life, is it? A very empty life. And then at the end of life, one finds that all that one has is just like sand in an hourglass. If you go to a place where there's like an old folks home, where people are nearing the end of their life, and you find that then all of the things that we think are very important as we're striving through life become basically insignificant. I've been to one of these places where, you know, somebody may have 14, 15 children who come visit them sometimes out of obligation. And they may have a lot of money, but still, all their money is getting them is that they have some nurse's aide that comes and turns them over in the middle of the night with a gruff voice. Oh, you got to be turned over again. Right? And they may be very accomplished, but who cares for their accomplishments when they're in a wheelchair shaking? So at that time of life, it becomes very obvious what is really important. But an intelligent person understands from the beginning that I want something spiritual in my life. I don't simply want to be a materialist. I don't want to be interested only in the temporary things of this world, which have no real substance. So how do we do that? How do we have real, genuine, eternal meaning in our life? So Krishna explains this in the Bhagavad Gita. We're going to look today at two verses that will answer our question of what does it mean to be spiritual and what's a very simple thing that we can do to bring genuine spiritual meaning to our life. So we're going to look at chapter 9. Chapter 9 is a very special chapter in the Bhagavad Gita. Krishna starts this chapter off saying, anybody know the beginning of chapter 9? Any Bhagavad Gita scholars here? What does Krishna start off chapter 9 with? Anyone know? No? Raja Vidya Raja Bhuyam. This is the king of all knowledge and very secret knowledge. And you may say, how is it secret knowledge if it's in a book? Anybody can buy the Bhagavad Gita and read it. What kind of secret is that? But it's secret because one doesn't understand it unless one has some purification of heart. So in this chapter 9, Krishna is really giving us the essence of all of his instructions. And in text 13, he says, Mahatmanas tu mam partha daivim prakritim ashritaha bhajantya nanda manaso gnatva bhuta dimavyayam. And what we're going to look at here is diving prakritim ashritam. Diving is very similar to the English word divine. That which is spiritual. Prakritim, energy. The spiritual energy. Ashritam means to take shelter. Those who are really spiritual. So nowadays, many people want to be spiritual, and they think that being spiritual means to have some crystals in their house, to go to hatha yoga classes, maybe have some angel figurines around. And if you're from India, maybe being spiritual means you have a little Ganesh murti over your door. And now I'm spiritual, you know. Or I have my little puja corner where I have my altar. And especially from India, I see many people have what I call the supermarket altar. One from this aisle and one from that aisle. And every Dave Devi you can think of. And hopefully I'll get my blessings if I just, you know, I want to hedge my bets and have everybody there. And then I'll do my little puja, and okay, now I'm spiritual. So Krishna's describing here that to be spiritual, to be under the diving prakriti, to have the ashrita, the shelter of the diving prakriti, or the divine energy, what does one have to do? Now, the divine energy, the spiritual energy, is a person. One of the wonderful things about the scriptures from India is that everything is personal. Everything is personal. Even in our modern life, still we can see that behind everything there is a person. In one sense, there is nothing impersonal. Just like this building, it's stone and wood, but behind this building there are people. There are people who planned it. There are people who worked hard to earn the money to build it. There are people who physically built the building. There are people who maintain it. Just like a few weeks ago, we had a big festival here where we were showering the deities with flowers. Maybe some of you were here then. And after we did that, then everybody was throwing flowers at each other. And the whole room was full of flowers, but now it's cleaned up. So that's done by a person. Everything is ultimately done by persons. Nothing happens automatically. Even if you have some machine that does things automatically, it's programmed by some person. The electricity is supplied from a powerhouse that's run by a person. If you go back to the source of anything, you will always find a person. So when we go to the source of what is spiritual, we will also find a person. And this person is a very extraordinary person. This person we have here on our altar, her name is Srimati Radharani. Aradhya means the one who gives the most worship. Rani means queen. She is the queen of worship. And she is this diving prakriti. She is the spiritual energy. So first of all, to be spiritual, one has to know who is the source of the spiritual. And so that is Radharani. And how do we come under the ashrita, under the shelter of this diving prakriti? So that is explained very nicely in the next verse, which is 9:14. Satatam kirtayantomam yatantascha dridavritaha namasyanchaschamam bhaktya nitya yukta upasate. Which Prabhupada translates as, always chanting my glories, my means Krishna, the Lord, endeavoring with great determination, bowing down before me, these great souls perpetually worship me with devotion. Why great souls? Because in the previous verse, when Krishna was talking about the diving prakritim ashrita, he started off with mahatmanas tumanparta. Mahatmanas, the great souls. When one takes shelter of the spiritual, one becomes a great soul. That doesn't mean that one's soul is literally bigger than anyone else's souls, but one becomes a very meritorious person. This is quite in contrast to how we try to gain status or position or meaning in the world. People in the world try to become a big person by having a lot of money or selling a lot of records, or hitting a ball a very long distance, writing a very famous book, or something like that. All of which turns to dust. All of which turns to dust. All the money that we collect, the books we write, the balls that we hit, the song, whatever we may do to become a great person within this world, it becomes forgotten. How far back in history do we remember great persons? Do you remember all those persons, those of us who were adults? You remember all those people we studied about in school? How many could we list now? 10, 20, 30 maybe? And you children who are in school, do you have to remember names of great people? This king and this president and this, right? Do you have to remember these names? How many do you remember? You remember them for a test? And then we forget, right? How many do you remember? How many great persons can we remember from 2,000 years ago history? Not very many. Let's see, Alexander the Great, Socrates,
Right? Huh? King Arthur. Okay, we're not even sure if he was a real person. So we have a short list out of the billions and billions of people. Those of us, many of us here, may be very educated people. And still, how many names do we remember? And then at least in Western culture, before 2,000 years, how many names are they remembering? Western culture hardly knows history going back more than 2,000 or 3,000 years. All forgotten. So whatever greatness we achieve in this world, it will be forgotten. How many of us know what our great-great-grandparents did? Or even what their names are? And they're our own family. We hardly know what to speak of great-great-uncle or like that. So to become a really great soul, one has to do something spiritual. Only the spiritual is permanent. And how did Krishna say to do this? He said to always be chanting his glories, endeavoring with great determination to bow down before him and to worship him with devotion. Those seem like pretty simple things to make one a great soul, to make one a great soul greater than the top names in history, which will be forgotten after a short period of time. And the one I really want to focus on today, because today is Ekadasi. Ekadasi literally means 11, and is the in our Vedic culture, we have a lunar calendar. So every 11th day of the moon, which means it occurs twice every lunar month, is called the 11th day, which is called the Ekadasi, which is a day on which one particularly takes vows. The Sanskrit name for vows is vrata. And this verse is talking about dridhavrata. So I want to read a little bit of Srila Prabhupada's purport. In devotional service, there are certain activities which are called determined, such as fasting on certain days, like the 11th day of the moon, Ekadasi, and on the appearance day of the Lord. All these rules and regulations are offered by the great acharyas for those who are actually interested in gaining admission into the association of the Supreme Personality of Godhead in the transcendental world. The Mahatmas, great souls, strictly observe all these rules and regulations, and therefore they are sure to achieve the desired result. And then Prabhupada says something in the next paragraph, which seems to be a little opposite, because first he's saying that we observe things like fasting and different austerities on these days, and then he says, not only is this devotional service easy, but it can be performed in a happy mood. One does not need to undergo any severe penance and austerity. Well, I thought he just told us we should be doing some austerity, like fasting. And then he says, we don't need to do any austerity. He can live this life in devotional service, guided by an expert spiritual master, and in any position, a householder, a renunciate, in any position, anywhere in the world, he can form devotional service and thus actually become a Mahatma. So we are enjoined that if we want to be spiritual, if we want to become a great person in a spiritual sense, we need to do some austerity, but we don't really need to do any severe austerity. And everything we should do can be in a happy mood. There's a wonderful song about Krishna's incarnation, Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, where it's described that his process of spirituality is Keva Ananda Kanda. It is simply joyful. You may say, well, how can fasting be joyful? Can fasting be joyful? Can it be joyful? Yes, it can be joyful. So, of course, a simple kind of fasting one can do on this Ekadasi, which anybody can do, is to eat any food at all, except, of course, we never eat meat, fish, or eggs, or onions, or garlic, but to avoid, in addition, grains and beans, the staple foods. So what does that leave you with? Dairy products, fruits, vegetables, nuts. And you'll find, just like we're going to serve our feast pretty soon, that one can have very opulent and delicious food prepared, not only pure vegetarian food, but prepared even without the staples, such as grains and beans. In fact, many people become expert at preparing cheesecake and all kinds of things without any grains and beans. So to fast in that way is very easy. You hardly even notice that's an austerity.
The traditional following of Ekadasi is to fast from, well, everything. No food at all from sunrise on Ekadasi until sunrise the next day. Not only no food, but those who strictly follow Ekadasi don't even take any water. And those who really strictly follow Ekadasi, they don't take any food, they don't take any water, and they also fast from, you know, sleep. They also fast from sleep. Now, while they're fasting from food, water, and sleep, what are they doing? They are eating something. They're not eating any food, they're not eating any water, and they're not eating any sleep. What are they eating? They're eating air, okay. Yes. I don't know of anyone who fasts from air on Ekadasi. You have to be a very big yogi to do that. Some yogis can do that. I've met two in my life who can do that. Don't imitate them. Who can actually fast from air? Only have to breathe like Dhruva Maharaj in our scripture. He was only breathing once every 12 days. But anyway, that's not for ordinary persons. No, they're eating something. Does anyone know what they're eating? They're eating the holy name, yes. They're eating the holy name. So the idea of this fasting, or eating more simply, even if you're fasting only from grains and beans, the idea of this vrata, taking a vow, is an expression of love. We find that in every religious tradition in the world, there is some idea of vows, isn't there? I know it doesn't matter what it is, whether it's Hindu or Muslim or Christian or Jewish or Buddhist. In every religious tradition, the scriptures, the holy teachers, they suggest that people take some vow. Some people take a vow once a year or once a month or once a week or something like that. But sometimes you take a vow. Of course, in modern society, people are very expert at what we call drinking water underwater while fasting on a fast day. In other words, a person is fasting from water, but while they take a bath, they're drinking water in the bath. So recently, a few months ago, I was at a country where, and I was there at this time of year, where one time of year they have a one-month fast. We won't say where this is, but I'm sure many of you can guess. So they have a one-month fast, and they don't eat anything, no food, no water, every day for a month from sunrise to sunset. So what many, not everybody, of course, but what many people do is they sleep during the day, and then they're up all night. I was in one of the main cities in this country, and the whole city is awake all night, and the restaurants are serving, and they're still eating breakfast, lunch, dinner. They're just eating breakfast at 7 o'clock at night, and lunch at 11 o'clock at night, and dinner at 3 o'clock in the morning. Okay? So that is not the idea. That is not the idea. The idea is not, okay, well, the scriptures give us this rule and this regulation for a vrata, for a vow, and okay, I will follow, we follow the letter of the law and not the spirit of the law. And why do people do this? Because nobody wants to take vows. Everybody wants simply to enjoy. So why is this there? Why, to become spiritual, does one take vows like this? And some people are so serious, even they'll fast from sleep. What is the purpose? As I was saying, it's an expression of love. It's an expression of love. Just like in the modern day now, marriage is going out of style. In some countries now, hardly anyone gets married anymore. Like Northern Europe, people are not getting married. They're still living together, they're still having children, but they're not getting married. More and more, like half the people in some countries now, they don't marry anymore. They say, what is the use of taking a vow? We love each other, why bother with a vow? So why in marriage is love shown by a vow? It's a way of expressing love. If I say, oh, I love you, but tomorrow I may be gone and love somebody else. If I don't like the way you cook, or I don't like how much money you make, You know, I won't love you anymore. Is that love? No, it's selfishness, isn't it? It's like a very young child. Or like an animal. I love you as long as you please me, and as soon as you don't please me, then I'm gone. But the idea of marriage, just like in the Christian weddings, they say, in happiness, distress, sickness, health, richer or poorer. That's love. Love is I take a vow, I'm going to stay with you for my whole life. I may be, when I'm marrying you, maybe you have millions of dollars, and maybe 2 days after I marry you, your business fails and you lose all your money. But still I am staying. Maybe when I marry you, you are very attractive. And maybe the next day you get in a car accident and you become deformed for the rest of your life. But still I am staying. That is love. So a vow is an expression of love. All sacrifice is an expression of love. How do we know who our real friends are? So we have an expression in the West, fair weather friends. Fair weather friends means when everything's going nice, they're your friends, and as soon as you're having some difficulty, you can't find them anymore. You know your real friends by people who are willing to sacrifice for you. And isn't that how we show people that we care? I show someone I care that I give up something that I like to please them. Friendship, love, relationships, it isn't just a matter of having fun together when it suits me. That's all right, but that's not very deep. It's not very deep. So if one wants to go deep into the spiritual, one makes a commitment. And there are different kinds of commitments one can make. One can make a lifetime commitment. Just like many of our members of the Hare Krishna movement, we take a lifetime vow. We take a vow, okay, rest of my life, I will not eat meat, fish, or eggs. Rest of my life, no illicit sex. Rest of my life, no intoxication, not even tea, not even Coca-Cola. What to speak of cigarettes or other things, alcohol. Rest of my life, no gambling. And whole life, I will take a vow that I will spend at least the time it takes to chant 16 times around the mala. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. So we make that commitment. So that's a lifetime vow. But there's also little vows. I'm going to make this sacrifice. I'm going to make this commitment. That's how we express love. Otherwise, love is just sentiment. What does sentiment mean? Sentiment means senses and mind. Senses and mind. It's not very deep. Anybody can say, oh yes, I'm spiritual, like I said in the beginning, you know. You just buy some little statue at a shop, you put it in a corner of your house, and you light a little flame there once a day, and now I am spiritual. You know, that does not, what is the meaning? Or anyone can say, yes, I love God. Once I went with a friend who was going for surgery, we went to the hospital early on a Sunday morning. And I don't know if you have them here in New Zealand, but in America on Sunday morning, the Christian evangelists are all on the television. And in the waiting room of the hospital, they had one of these Christian evangelists there. Actually, they had. We tried changing the channels, but there was that was all. We couldn't turn it off. And all we had choices of different evangelical preachers. And one of them was preaching to a stadium of like 25,000 people and saying, you just send me $5 and I will pray for you and you will be cured. And then in another one, there were all these people holding hands saying, I love Jesus. So that's nice. Anyone can say, yes, I love Jesus. Yes, I love Krishna. Oh yes, I am always thinking of Krishna. But how do we show our love? We show our love again with commitment and with sacrifice. So these smaller vows are a way of making a meaningful gesture of love. And especially these vows help to disconnect us from the material. It's easy to say, no, I'm not a materialist. But are we willing to sacrifice a little bit of our eating for a few hours? So this is a good indication. It's a good way of showing, yes, I'm not interested in the material. I'm going to spend some time not doing the most basic of material things, which is eating. And I'm going to spend that time instead doing the most basic of spiritual things, which is absorption in the name of the Lord. Absorption in the divine, daivim prakritim ashritam. To really take shelter in the divine. So that is how one becomes spiritual. It's quite simple, actually. One makes an intentional, determined effort that at least for some time, at least for a certain time every day, a certain time every month, I am going to remove myself from the things of this world, and I'm going to take that same time and energy that I would have given to the things of this world, and I'm going to give them to the spiritual. It's something really that anybody can do. It's not a difficult thing. At the very least, one can say, all right, I will not eat non-vegetarian food, and I will spend some time every day really reading the Bhagavad Gita and chanting the names of Krishna. But even if one is doing that every day, these days like Ekadasi help our daily practice. Sometimes when we are engaged in our spiritual practice, we may wish that we could go deeper into meditation on our practices, isn't it? Sometimes even when we're doing spiritual activities, we may find that our mind is drawn back to the material. We're there reading the Gita, and our mind is thinking, I wonder what's happening to my stocks, are they going up or down? Oh, I need to bring my car in to be repaired. Oh, my son has a big exam coming up. I wonder if he's going to make it into medical school. I wonder how my mother's doing. She's not very well. And here, when one's reading the Bhagavad Gita, one is chanting the names of God, and one's mind is going to matter. So taking a time when one focuses just on the spiritual. All right, 2 days a month. 2 days a month. By the lunar calendar. These days, I will make a special effort. I'll make an increased effort that something else, I won't even think about anything else. I won't turn the news on the television or the radio or the internet. I won't talk about anything in the world. I won't even eat very much. How can I do extra things? And while I'm doing extra things, just focus. And then one will find that even one's daily spiritual practices are enhanced. But whatever one can do, even if it's something very small, is a good start. Okay, I'll make this little start. I'll sacrifice this little material thing and just increase a little bit the spiritual. And then one can do a little more, sacrifice a little bit more on the material, take a little more on the spiritual. Oh, but didn't Prabhupada also say here that it should be performed in a very happy mood? So we're not suggesting that one remove oneself from the material and delve into the spiritual in some mood of pain or resentment or, all right, I'm going to do some sacrifice. Not like that. Even in our normal relations, our loving relationships, which we show by sacrifice, are done in a happy mood. If I say to someone I love, here's your birthday present,
I worked really hard for 2 months for this, and you better...
I mean, who? That's not love. Therefore, it must be done willingly. It must be done willingly. Now, one is thinking, yes, I love my husband, I love my wife, I love my child, I love whatever, my friend, my boss, my coworker. I want to go to the shop. I want to sacrifice 3 hours of my time to go to the shop. And I want to sacrifice $20, $50, $100 of my money, which represents so many hours of my time, to buy them a gift. And what is my happiness when I sacrifice like that for someone I like? What is my happiness? That they're pleased with me, right? Their pleasure is my happiness. So it's the same when one devotes oneself to the spiritual. One learns to take happiness in pleasing the Lord, in His happiness. And therefore, one who takes happiness in pleasing Krishna and in Krishna's pleasure finds that these vratas are actually very joyful. One starts to want to do more and more and more. Just like if you sacrifice to give a gift to someone you love and they're very happy. Oh, thank you. Oh, look at what you gave me. I've always wanted this. And they're so grateful and they use it. Don't you want to give them another gift? Isn't it? So when we take some vrata, some vow to please Krishna, and we feel Krishna's pleasure, then we naturally want to do more. Oh, what more can I do for Krishna? 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 It doesn't feel anymore like a sacrifice. Oh, I can't eat any beans today. Oh, it doesn't feel like that. Oh, I can do something for Krishna. I can give up beans today for Krishna. I can give up food and water and sleep today for Krishna. And one starts to feel more and more and more joyful. And when one does that, one is starting to accumulate credits in a spiritual bank account. We were talking about materialism. You know, you do so many things in this world, at the end you have nothing. And when you die, what do you take with you? Only your karmic reactions. You don't take your money, you don't nothing, right? If you're lucky, there'll be 2 lines about you in the newspaper. If you're really lucky, then some poor child will have to memorize your name for an exam for the next 100 years or so. If you really get to be a big person, some poor school children will be cursing you. Ah, why do I have to remember this name? Right? But when we put things in our spiritual bank account, that stays with us eternally, because we are actually spiritual beings. And as we develop this loving relationship with Krishna through the process of giving to Him and relinquishing the material, that relationship develops more and more and more and more and more. And then finally, Trakpadeham Punarjanma Mameti. One goes to Krishna when giving up this body, when no longer has to go in the cycle of birth and death. And even in this life, before giving up the body, one starts to have one's real wealth, one's real treasure, and one's real heart in the spiritual. One is then taken full shelter, ashrita, in this diving prakriti. And then one's life is fully spiritual. So does anyone have any questions, comments? Yes. Well, the main difficulty if one doesn't follow these vows is that one will be forced to follow vows for useless purposes. Nobody can live without austerity. Just like some of you are in school. Do you have to work hard to do your schoolwork? Is it always just fun? Those of us who finished school, was it a lot of austerity? Yes? What about earning a living? Do you have to make sacrifices to earn a living? Do any of us have pain and suffering in our life that we don't want? Those are forced austerities. We may have forced vows. We may be sick and be forced to only eat certain food. So if one doesn't take up voluntary vows for the sake of the spiritual, one will be forced by one's previous activities to take up vows and sacrifice for the material. And if all it is material, it is just sin. So my main answer would be that if one doesn't voluntarily take up some sacrifice to be under the shelter of the spiritual energy, one will be forced to take up so many sacrifices to be under the shelter of the material energy. And what is the profit? So much sacrifice. So you get your education, you get your MA, PhD, and then next life you will have to learn your alphabet all over again. Right? Isn't it? You make sacrifices to become, we're talking about Mahatma, to become a great person in the world. And next life, nobody knows. You're just a little baby, and nobody comes to you and says, oh, weren't you the Nobel Prize winner in your last life? So that is the main reaction. Now, for those who are already on the spiritual path, then it's different. That's a different thing. Just like before you marry somebody, before you've made a commitment to them, if you don't do any duties toward them, there's no specific reaction. You follow? If I'm not married to anybody, the fact that I don't cook dinner for my husband doesn't mean anything because I don't have a husband. But once you're married, then if you don't perform your duties, then it's not very nice. You know, once you have children, if you don't feed them, and that's not very good, they may haul you off. But you have social services here in this country that will take you away if you don't feed your children. So once one makes a commitment to Krishna, once one says, I will dedicate my whole life to the spiritual, and then not following these vows has a more serious repercussion. But generally, one follows vows voluntarily is much better than following them by force. Actually, even from a material point of view, the way that karma works is if you take some voluntary austerity, then you don't have to suffer so much involuntary austerity. Because our difficulties are due to sinful actions performed in a previous life. And just like if someone commits a crime, they usually have the option of doing community service. They can do some kind of voluntary austerity, isn't it? If I steal something from you and I voluntarily say, all right, I will reimburse you what I stole plus interest, then you may not even press charges. Isn't that a fact? So if we do voluntary austerity, that lessens our bad karmic reactions, just even from a material point of view. So anytime you don't take voluntary difficulty, you will have involuntary difficulty. And if any of you have involuntary difficulty that you would like to reduce, take some voluntary difficulty for a good cause. Is that all right? Yes. All right. So you're making the point that many people may say, well, I don't want to take a vow that I may not be able to fulfill. Better not to take a vow at all. Well, you have a risk either way, you see. So if I promise you something and I can't do it, that's really bad. But if I never promise you anything, then we don't really have a very solid relationship. I never even get a chance at having a solid relationship if I make no commitment at all. So if I say I want to be spiritual, I want to add something spiritual in my life, but I'm so afraid of failure that I don't make a commitment, I'm probably not going to have much of anything spiritual. It's better to make a commitment and do one's best, even if one may fail, than not to even try. I mean, also we have to understand that Krishna is a person. And if there's difficulty due to things beyond our control, then he understands that. Yeah. But if it's just something, how would you say, whimsical. Okay, today I promise I'm going to do this for Krishna. Oh, now I decided I'm not going to do it. There's not much meaning to that. No, that's, if you think you're going to do that, no, better not to promise. That's a fact. So best to promise things that you feel you have a reasonable ability to do. And you can try, you know. So if now you're eating non-veg, you can say, all right, at least every Ekadasi I'll be vegetarian. Try it. If you're already a vegetarian, okay, now every Ekadasi I'll try giving up grains and beans. Little step. I had one friend who said, that's not very big trouble. Why bother at all if that's all you're doing? I said, at least you remember it's a special day. At least it reminds you. So you do that maybe for years. You're just giving up grains and beans. And it's not a problem. You've been doing it without any difficulty. Then you can say, okay, what more step can I take? Oh, maybe now I can chant more. Maybe now on Ekadasi, you know, I won't look at the news. And you do that for a while. And you say, oh, that's easy. 2 days a month I don't look at the news. Or 2 days a month I don't watch movies or something. You follow? And then you try a little more. And you say, okay, well now I've been doing that for a few months. I don't eat grains and beans, I'm not looking at anything about the material world, and I'm spending a half an hour meeting Bhagavad Gita. Oh, now maybe on Ekadasi I can do this. And it may be that a person takes a vow for every Ekadasi, it may be that a person takes a vow on some Ekadasis. Maybe on some Ekadasi you have a major paper due to the university, or you have some big meeting with somebody at work, and just not eating grains and beans is all you can do. And maybe some other Ekadasi, like this is a Sunday, maybe some other Ekadasi, it's a time when you don't have a lot of obligations, and you can say, oh, today I'm just going to sit and chant for 5 hours. And only I'm going to take some pieces of fruit. So one can try. And what one will see is that as one sacrifices for the sake of spiritual advancement, that Krishna is very happy and he reciprocates. And he brings you great, great joy. And just like I was saying, you give a gift to someone and they're so happy, and then you want to do more. Does that answer your question? Is that right? Anybody else? So there's still time left in this Ekadasi. It goes on until sunrise tomorrow morning. So there is still time to make even to go before the deity, okay? My dear Lord, from now until next sunrise, I will spend, whatever, half an hour with Bhagavad Gita. I'll spend, time chanting your name. I'll have a bhajan. I'll give in charity. Something that will really tie us to the spiritual. And to come to the point where everything, yat karoshi, yat adnasi, yat jahosi, vidasi, yat tapasasi kanteya, tat purushvam adarpanam, where everything that we do becomes dedicated to the spiritual. So thank you very much. All glories to Srila Prabhupada.